This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We all know a dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. That's problem enough for us. But it's a real drag when you sell something that everybody wants to pay for in greenbacks. Oil, for instance. OPEC is making noises about our money not being good anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 19th of November today. Oil closed up about 80 cents, $94.64 a barrel. But for OPEC countries, the issue is not the price so much as the currency it is tendered in. Cartel members met in Saudi Arabia over the weekend, where some of them went out of their way to badmouth their biggest customer, us. Because the greenbacks that we've been sending to pay for our oil aren't worth what they used to be. And that, in turn, is cutting into OPEC's profits. This morning, we woke up to an announcement that Iran will no longer use the lowly dollar to price its oil. Let's be clear that the dollar slide isn't new. It's off 25% against the euro in the past 5 years. But when OPEC speaks, people listen, which has raised some concerns about whether the rest of the world might follow suit. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Iran began moving away from the dollar 2 years ago and already prices 80% of its crude in either euros or yen.
There's a lot less to it than meets the eye.
Tom Wallen of the publishing company Energy Intelligence says the long-term oil contracts Iran sells for euros and yen are actually pegged to the dollar. That's because all oil sold on short-term spot markets is still priced in dollars, and those markets influence how Iran and other countries set long-term prices.
They could insist that they get paid in euros or in yen or some other currency, but they're always going to be in a dollar starting point. It's more symbolic, I think, than having, you know, much real commercial or financial impact.
Wallen says Iran's leaders want to show local audiences they're standing up to the U.S. Still, given the greenback's falling value, Martin Bailey at the Brookings Institution expects oil exporters like Russia or Mexico to start using other currencies.
And we may coexist with both the dollar and the euro serving as benchmark currencies. But also keep in mind that you don't want to be in the position of dumping dollars because you're only making yourself worse off. If they have a lot of dollar assets, they don't really want to start unloading those and seeing the value of the dollar fall because they're shooting themselves in the foot.
If producers gradually move away from dollar pricing, the value of foreign oil would become subject to fluctuations in other currencies, and that would mean more of a roller coaster at American pumps. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
This is probably not going to come as a surprise, but the people who build houses in this country are a bit depressed. The National Association of Home Builders announced its November index today. Builder sentiment is stuck at record lows. The group says a real estate turnaround is years away. The residential market has certainly been hurt by subprimes, but until now, commercial real estate had seemed immune. There is evidence today, though, that the credit crunch has spread. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Moody's Investor Service says commercial real estate values fell 1.2% from August to September. That may not seem like a big drop, but commercial real estate prices were going strong, in some places flirting with record highs. The report also found that the number of broken deals in September reached a six-year high. And Tad Phillip with Moody's says the swan dive isn't over yet for office and apartment buildings.
We expect to see a few more downward-oriented reports from here.
How far down?
Well, that's certainly the big question, and we're guessing for now mid to high single digits.
The reversal could push some commercial property owners into default, just like it did for homeowners who ended up owing more than their property was worth. But economist Richard DeKayser with National City Corporation says we're not looking at another subprime debacle here.
I would be reluctant to embrace this as the first sign of a major decline.
DeKayser says overall commercial vacancy rates remain low and rents are up. He's not ready to push the panic button just yet. But David Olson with mortgage research firm Wholesale Access says the new numbers show the subprime mess is spreading.
We got big problems here. Everyone's going to be impacted. It's widening. We thought we could confine it to one sector, but it's not being confined.
Olson says commercial real estate values are pointing in the same direction as the housing market and auto industry. Down. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Down as well are donations to food banks. More than 12 million households in this country had trouble getting enough food last year. That's only slightly more than when hungry in 2005, but food banks across the country are struggling. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains why.
Every week, around 1,400 families get groceries from the Yorkville Common Pantry in Manhattan.
It's a combination of cereal, some canned products such as vegetables, fruit, some type of a protein, whether it's beans, peanut butter.
Carol Ann Johns directs the pantry. She says it gets some food from the Federal Emergency Food Supply. It also relies on donations from area churches, synagogues, and schools. Since April, the number of people coming to Yorkville for help has gone up by a third, but there's no extra food coming in. John says the pantry, which also runs a soup kitchen, won't turn people away.
So what we ultimately have done is tried to kind of spread what we have going further to a larger number of people.
Hunger activists say more people are turning to places like Yorkville because food stamps and other benefits aren't enough to feed them all month long. And high rents and utility prices mean some people are having to choose between paying the electric bill and eating supper. Anya Duggan is with the Food Bank for New York City. It's an umbrella organization for pantries and soup kitchens around the five boroughs.
We're seeing a shortage of federally funded emergency food coming into the emergency food system, and that's happening throughout the country.
The Farm Bill dictates both food stamp benefits and the emergency food supply. For now, the bill is stuck in the Senate. Meanwhile, Duggan says that drop in federal help means private donations make up a growing proportion of food aid across the country. If those donations don't pick up, she says, there'll be a lot of hungry families this winter. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Yes, that was another 200-point drop on the Dow today. Glad you noticed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I was at a business lunch on Thursday, and in the course of things, the group got to talking about Black Friday, which, as it happens, is this Friday, the day the holiday shopping season gets going in earnest. Anyway, there was a guy at lunch who said he actually enjoys hitting the malls at 4 o'clock in the morning stuffed with turkey with a couple of hundred other people. I don't see it myself, but the retail industry has come to count on the day after Thanksgiving as a bellwether for how holiday sales are going to go. This year, most analyst estimates are for something like a 4% increase over last year. But how do they know? Marshall Cohen's the chief analyst at the market research firm NPD Group. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
How do you guys know what you know about what we're going to do on Friday? Do you all use the same methodology?
Actually, no. for every different industry that's being tracked, there are different types of methods to do it. For example, some companies look at holiday sales as just being November and December. I personally look at November, December, and include January in holiday sales because January is just as much a part of holiday today as it's ever been before.
As critical as holiday shopping is, though, to the economy, I mean, you read all the statistics, wouldn't we all be better served if you guys could agree on one way to figure out what we're going to do?
The key here is recognizing that not everybody looks at the holiday business with the same perspective, and the end results are different as well. For example, the retail industry is looking to have a spokesperson that can create good momentum. So there's a little bit of bias based in the answers. When you look at the financial institutions and their view, in some cases, they're not only looking for sales volume, they're looking for profitability as well. Depending upon what your end result is the method that you're going to use to determine what the holiday forecast will be.
So do you sort of skew the data a little bit, depending on what you want to find out?
I wouldn't say that anybody skews the data, but you can certainly look at numbers and create different views.
So actually, it's more than just sticking your finger in the wind and saying 4% this year.
Now, there is a science to it. Everybody has a methodology that they use. Some use different standards, and that's the key. It's not that it's not scientific. It's just that there isn't an industry-wide formula that's being used from institution to institution.
When one of your competitors comes out with their analysis, do you read it and say, no way, they left out X factor or Y factor, and that can't possibly be right?
Those are the first words that always come out of my mouth.
Marshall Cohen at the NPD Group. Mr. Cohen, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Sitcoms and late-night talk shows have been forced into reruns. Broadway shows have gone dark. But commentator and striking writer Sandra Tsinglow says, consider the teachers.
Oh, baby, don't you know? I know the lowdown.
It's week three of the writer's strike, and we know you're sick of hearing about it. After all, it's not a deaf-mute strike. You've got 10,000-plus writers with free time on their hands, churning out passionate op-eds, wordy blogging, a fair amount of YouTubery. Geez, why don't celebrities visit our picket lines, a friend of mine groused the other day, snapping off the TV. Whither John Edwards, Jay Leno, that guy from that show? You see, my friend is also a member of a union. Not the Teamsters, Set Carpenters, or even Garment Workers Union, which has a certain blue-collar poetry, but the teachers' union. Wendy has been owed $2,000 since March due to a snafu in Los Angeles Unified's supposedly brilliant new computerized payroll system. It has left thousands paid either too much or too little, some not paid at all for months due to the fact that 9 months' salaries are spread across 12 months in like 54 different wage class categories, so the W-2s are processed as 1099s as opposed to... That's the problem with labor disputes. Try to understand what's going wrong and one gets lost in a mire of technical detail and rising health insurance deductibles. And what about dental? As opposed to what we writers chant on our picket lines. Hey, hey, what do we get? Nothing for the internet. And yes, I have been on the picket lines, but I'm not going to bore you with the details. But considering how I got into the Writers Guild, writing scripts I'm embarrassed about, my striking simply means no further harm will be done. It makes a telling contrast to public school music teacher Wendy, who waited 11 hours downtown to try to get paid on her day off because she couldn't bear to miss work and let down her kids. Someone should write a movie about a heroine like that. On spec, of course.
Sandra Tsinglow lives in Los Angeles. No matter where you live, send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. The stalled nuclear deal between the U.S. and India has new life. On Friday, communist parties in New Delhi's coalition government changed their minds. They now say they'll support the agreement. Interestingly, domestic Indian politics that weakened the communists had a lot to do with it. There were food riots last month in the state of West Bengal, which is ruled by the communists. For more than a year, shopkeepers there were selling government-subsidized rice and wheat on the black market. Sunita Thakur reports.
Fed up with their rations being ripped off, villagers took matters into their own hands. Shopkeeper Hassan Khan and his family watched in terror as dozens of these villagers, waving sticks and shouting angrily, marched up his driveway looking for him and his brother.
We saw them coming and locked ourselves up in the house. We could hear them screaming for me to cut off my brother's head and hands. When we didn't respond, that's when they started looting the shop and smashing windows and shelves.
Villagers have long suspected that ration shop owners were selling government-subsidized food on the open market. Over the last year, their ration supplies have dwindled and prices in the open market have doubled. According to Segnor Vogt, one of the village rioters, this situation was allowed to go on because many ration shop owners are members of the governing left party. Given their vulnerability, shopkeepers have changed their attitude now.
Now they are frightened. All this time they had the party behind them, so they weren't afraid. Now they plead with us to take rations. Wheat, rice, whatever you want, they say. This wasn't the case earlier.
The villagers, realizing they wouldn't eat if the shops remained closed, began to return the stolen goods. Ration dealers like Hassan Khan very cautiously opened shop again.
The police saved us and the village people are telling us not to close shop. Where will we go for rations? The problem really is that our system has gone wrong.
The West Bengal's Food and Supplies Minister, Paresh Adhikari, has chalked out a long list of ways to remedy the problem. First order of business, transparency.
Food prices will be posted in offices, newspapers, boards, everywhere, so that people will know what they can and can't get at ration shops and what they'll pay.
There'll be some relief for ration shop owners, too. They'll be compensated for higher transport and transaction costs. It's a delicate fix to forestall another riot in pre-election season. In West Bengal, this is Sunita Thakur for Marketplace.
Coming up, how big of a deal can one little button on a website really be?
Basically, you have $110 million of revenue loss per year associated with that button.
So, a big deal then. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street kicked off an abbreviated holiday week with light trading and lots of volatility. The Dow Industrials closed down 218 points. 1 2/3% to 12,958. The Nasdaq lost 43 points, 1 2/3% there as well. Finished at 2,593. The S&P 500 sank 25 points, 1 3/4%. Wrapped up trading at 1,433. Citigroup shares fell almost 6% on news the country's biggest bank might have to write off another $15 billion in bad loans over the next 6 months. Countrywide Financial dropped more than 12%. Lowe's, the big home improvement chain, forecast new lows today. It lowered its profit outlook for the second time in 2 months. The stock sawed off more than 7.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for October. A couple of turkeys that won't be at the Thanksgiving feast are pardoned by President Bush. And the latest story on toys comes out tomorrow. The Consumer Product Safety Commission releases its annual safety tips for picking gifts for kids. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. While the American economy sorts its way through the liquidity squeeze, China's got exactly the opposite problem, too much money floating around out there. Beijing has increased what's called the reserve requirement 9 times this year. That is, the government's ordered banks to take money out of circulation as a way to cool that red-hot economy just a little bit. But Chinese consumers aren't necessarily playing along. Our China correspondent Scott Tong is here to tell us they have discovered the joys of plastic. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right. So listen, what are we learning about Chinese consumers and credit cards?
We're learning that the younger generation in China is getting used to the concept of having a credit card in their wallet. The people who are under 24 in China are, a lot of people call them the little emperors. It's because they are only children, and they get a whole lot of attention from their parents and grandparents, and they've grown up in this new age of disposable income in China. And it's showing up in some of these polls is that this is going to be the big spender generation in China.
What about the role of cash in that economy, though? I mean, when I was living there, if you wanted to buy, like, an airplane ticket, right, you had to get $800 American dollars worth of Chinese currency, which is a whole wad of cash, and go down and do that transaction in person in cash at the airline office. Has that changed at all?
No. When we have to buy an airline ticket, we call the travel agent and we say we want to charge it to the company credit card, and the travel agent groans because she hates it. She has to pay this merchant fee that merchants in China are not used to, and so we have to negotiate that. And not only that, then she has to send over this guy in the motorcycle with the little credit card swiping machine, and then I have to sign it and send it back to her. So credit is pretty new in China. Let me just throw one statistic at you. 85% of cars are bought in cash. So that tells you, you know, credit is an exciting concept, but it's still pretty new here.
What about the people who stand to make money off those transactions? Not the merchants, but the big Western banks. They've got to be just chomping at the bit here to get into that market.
They are. They've been lining up, and the way they've been trying to get into this is to invest in the big Chinese banks. And what they want to do is a few things. First of all, get the credit cards into people's pockets, and that's starting to happen. Step number two is get the people to use them, which isn't always happening. One market researcher told me that a lot of young people like to get a credit card, but they never use it. They just want the free toaster that comes with a credit card. And, of course, the last step is not only to use it, but to carry a balance, right? The good old American 21% interest and to keep carrying that. Well, the vast majority of people who use credit cards in China, they pay it off at the end of the month. You know, so if you're a bank, what's the point?
That, of course, speaks to the fact that the national savings rate over there is something like 45% or 50%. What would an increased use of credit in the economy mean for the Chinese economy? I mean, it's not like they need it to grow anymore over there.
Well, they need to, what economists describe as kind of rebalancing the economy. The Chinese economy is too dependent on the state investing in large infrastructure products, too dependent on exporting stuff. And so the long-term plan is to have more of the economy leaning on domestic consumption. So consumer credit and credit cards are seen as, hopefully, part of that solution in China.
So we've tracked you down on the road, Scott, which leads me to this question. How are you paying for your hotel room tonight?
Well, I hope I'm paying it on the company credit card. But just in case, I've always got the cash backup, so I'm carrying around like, $1,000 in my bag, just in case I need it.
Oh, $1,000 just in case. Scott Tong on the road someplace in China. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai.
The next big event in the Googleization of the whole world could come at the end of January. The Federal Communications Commission is going to be auctioning off a key chunk of the wireless airwaves. The search company is expected to join in the bidding, and it could, if all the speculation is right, turn out to be the 700 megahertz foundation of a whole new mobile network. Obviously, a lot has changed for Google since it began searching back in 1998. But on its crisp white homepage, one little button has managed to stick around all these years. Marketplace's Brendan Noonan decided to find out why.
Google's main search page is renowned for its elegance and simplicity. But there's one distraction on the site that fellow Californian Dirty Harry summed up nicely.
You could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky?
And common wisdom has it that obscure doohickeys like the I'm Feeling Lucky button confuse users and waste their time. Jacob Nielsen, a leading web usability expert, says that stands in sharp contrast to the rest of the pristine page.
Google search page is great from usability perspective because there's no doubt about what you do. I'm Feeling Lucky is less usable because most people have no clue what it means.
So what does it mean? I typed in the search words I'm Feeling Lucky button into Google, and then I hit the I'm Feeling Lucky button. My computer did not rip a hole in the space-time continuum. It took me to a definition. The I'm Feeling Lucky button directs you to the first page Google returns for your query. So where did the idea for a button that anticipates exactly what you want come from? There are only two people in the world who can answer that question, and I was lucky enough to bump into one of them when I visited Google. Sergey Brin is the co-founder of Google.
The reason it's called I'm Feeling Lucky is, of course, that's a pretty damn ambitious goal. I mean, to get the exact right one thing without even giving a list of choices. And so you have to feel a little bit lucky if you're going to try that with one go.
That's one of the other problems with the button. It doesn't always take you where you want to go. But since it's there, surely people must be using it. Marissa Meyer is a Google vice president and responsible for everything on the search page. She says, not really.
I would say it's less than 1% of our searches are done through the I'm Feeling Lucky route.
Even Sergey Brin admits that he hardly uses it.
Do you use it ever? I sometimes use it, though rarely.
Tom Chavez heads Wrapped, a company that helps determine what advertising real estate on a web page is worth. He did the math on how much the 1% of people who don't use the button are costing the company.
Basically, you have $110 million of revenue loss per year associated with that button.
That's because the company makes a lot of its money by selling ads on its search results page. People who are feeling lucky never see that page, and therefore Google's ads, because the I'm Feeling Lucky button automatically directs them to a non-Google site.
Well, it is potentially a bit of a head-scratcher, right?
So why exactly do they keep it around? Marissa Meyer again.
You know, Larry and Sergey had the view, and I certainly share it, that it's possible just to become too dry, too corporate, too much about making money. And, you know, what I think is really delightful about Google and both the I'm Feeling Lucky is that they remind you that the people here have personality and that they have interest and that there's real people.
But Nielsen, the web usability expert, says the whimsy serves another business purpose.
By loosening up their reputation, by sort of still maintaining this feeling of, oh, we are just two kind of grad students hanging out and having a beer and having a grand old time, not, you know, we are 16,000 people working on undermining your privacy.
As Google continues to draw the attention of competitors, regulators, and yes, privacy advocates, showing that human face is one way to make the company appear less threatening, Google's pressing the I'm Feeling Lucky button and hoping it'll bring them the exact result they want. In Mountain View, California, I'm Brendan Noonan for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to keep your Thanksgiving travel plans zipping right along. This week is the busiest time in holiday travel, as we all know. And the Transportation Security Administration is trying to avoid delays by acting a little bit like your mom. They want you to be neater. Today, the TSA launched a new campaign urging travelers to eliminate clutter in their carry-on bags. They claim slobs are more likely to face extra inspections because screeners tend to search messier bags, adding almost 3 minutes to each and every check-in, which, when you multiply by 27 million airline passengers over the next week, adds up to some really long security lines. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tumbled 218 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ gave up 43 points, also 1.6%. The S&P 500 sacrificed 25 points. That's about 1.75% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, a traveler's nightmare. You get to the airport on time, but there's no place to park.
And panic stricken you, and now you begin to worry whether or not you're going to miss your flight.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.